This is Carl Sherman, and this is side two of the fourth sawmill tape. I think today I will take up some of the things in the sawmill that come up that has nothing really to do with the boards, but the boards wouldn't come out unless you had them. One thing is what they call cruising. You are estimating the amount of timber in a particular section of timber. So the amount of board feet, million board feet, there was in the timber there. Sometimes there would be a set price, say of X number of dollars for X number of million board feet. So and the cruiser, there was a regular occupation, what they call a cruiser, would go through and estimate how many million board feet there was in a particular section. Now, Dad Sherman was real good at cruising. He never did it as a vocation, however. He just would go through and this one particular time, he went through this patch of timber, and a cruiser had just cruised it, and Dad Sherman come up with about 80%. Well, I don't know whether it was I said something or whether somebody else said something. How come he's so far off? And Dad Sherman said, well, he said, there's a number of trees there, all right. But he said, there were only about 80% would make good lumber. So that put a section on it right there. We never got that patch of lumber, patch of timber. One thing that is kind of interesting, this was really before my time. See, I don't remember much back beyond, say about 1915 or 16. So, but I knew about this. Lots of times people would come out from the east and they would pick up a section of land with timber, and they would homestead this land. And then, of course, they had, in the homesteading, they had to build a house and live on the land for so long and that type of thing. They had definite rules that the government set up. But, and of course, they'd most always build their cabin down along a creek or somewhere where they could get water and that sort of stuff. So when they would prove up on their homestead, it would be theirs, why they could sell it. So lots of times a sawmill man would come by and hey, they had a section of timber here and it's pretty good, and here's this creek here, we can have a sawmill right here. And they would buy that whole section of them from the people, land and all, and then set up the sawmill and cut the timber all off, and generally just give it back to the people or sell it to them for a dollar, make it legal, or let it go for taxes, whichever. Lots of times the people would move away. Sometimes people would just stay there and work in the sawmill until it was ready, and they'd those people would get all the extra houses and so forth, shacks that had been put up, and have a real start for their farm. So that was kind of interesting to have a homestead. Another thing that comes to mind on this logging deal, Now, this is before my time also, because they, as far as I know, from about 1910 on, why they quit the idea. You'd go around through the woods where it had been logged maybe, say, 10 years before. Why, you'd find these big, high stumps, 10, 12 feet high, great big stumps there. As a little kid, way, I used to crawl up on top of them. There'd be some holes in the side of it that they put the springboard, and you could generally, a springboard was a board. They would cut a hole in the side of the tree, and they'd stick this board in there. Then they could stand up on it. And where they were cutting these things up 10 or 12 feet high, well, there was a whole string of these holes, and that little kid, I could climb up on these little holes real nice. And, of course, the reason I was up on, wanting to get up on top of these tall stumps was that they would rot out in the center up there. The water would stand in the center of the stump and rot out and form a little soil up there, and the birds would bring some kind of berry bushes or something. Principally, I would be climbing up there to get some huckleberries, red huckleberries. We had, around through the woods there, we had these red huckleberries, and then we had these purple elderberries, and then the salmonberries and the black caps. A little kid, I'd fill up on those berries. Of course, the birds helped me too. Now, the reason that they were cutting these trees so high and just taking the best part of the tree to log, none of the tops and none of these bottoms, was that when a large tree grows, or any tree grows, or as far as that goes, any shrub or anything grows that grows up a ways, why, it will just kind of pick up some of the soil or a rock or two or more in the center of it, like more or less in the roots, among the roots, and they'll, as the thing grows up, it raises that rock right up with it. So in the earlier days, they had even poor or not as good iron or steel as we did when I was in on it. And they would, if they cut this log down, say, at just normal height from the, as you stood up, way you would pick up these rocks, and these saws, not being such good steel, they would hit this rock or dirt or whatever it was, and generally foul up their saw, break it or something. One time, I wasn't at the mill at the time, but I seen the hole in the roof. One of our saws that we used, we had pretty good saws, pretty good steel at that time, but not exceptional, not like they do now. This particular log they were cutting along there, and all of a sudden it hit a rock, I believe, and broke a chunk out of the saw, oh, about a foot square. Well, it wasn't square, but about that size. And of course, it was running full speed. It threw that piece of metal right up through the roof and of the sawmill, and clear out into the yard out there about, oh, I don't know, quarter of a mile or so. It just really threw it out there. Some of the men finally happened to find it out there. But I didn't know about that, but I could see the hole in the roof. So you see the reason for them just taking the best part of the tree when they were first logging. That got out of style about the time that I come onto the scene. The whole thing was that metal, iron and steel and so forth, was at a premium around the 1900s and a little earlier. There were no smelters or no way of getting iron here in the, as I get it, in the Northwest here. And everything had to come in more or less by ship or after the railroads got in, by rail. So Dad Sherman tells a story about, I don't know whether it was his sawmill or whether it was one next to him there somewhere in the St. Helens, Columbia County area, that they broke the saw and they had to shut the mill down, and they didn't get it started up till long in the spring when a ship come in from the east to bring them a new saw. So, see, quite a deal there. These saws, they were only about, a quarter of an inch thick, something like that. And as they would run by, they cut the log, they would heat. Now, that was quite a lot. The sawyer's job was to just feed the saw feed the carriage through the saw at just as slow a speed, or just as fast a speed as he could. And he could watch it and see that it was getting a little hot or anything. He had some a water pipe there. He could put water on it, which he did quite a lot. And especially when they happened to hit a pitch pocket or something, and this saw would get hot, and it would actually warp or change, not nice and straight. I know that I used to like to watch a sawyer, or Dad Sherman used to do it lots of times on, and when he was sawing, lots of times on, along in the evening in the summertime, or on Sunday when in the wintertime when it was dark, he had a straight edge that he'd put on his saw, and then he would had a big anvil there, a big chunk of metal that he could lay it on, and a hammer, a certain kind of hammer that he would hammer. He would hammer these saws that had gotten bent a little bit, and check them with a straight edge, and by hammering some on one side and turning it over and hammering on the other way, he got the thing pretty well straightened out again. Of course, probably the next time they got hot again, it would change. But at least he'd start out with a saw nice and straight. Of course, Dad Sherman learned his lesson about the having to wait for the ship to come in. He always had, probably seven or eight saws. Of course, now they were different size. The main saw, say the main saw was 4 feet across. He'd probably have maybe three of them. And then this top saw, see, when the log got too big for the bottom saw to cut it, they had a saw up on top. And normally, when they were running the small logs, they didn't have a saw up there at all. It just was there. But it was set just, the top saw was set just a little ahead of the other saw so that it would cut the full side off. And he could cut then a log, maybe 5 or 6 feet through were by using both saws. So the top saw, he generally only had a couple of them because he didn't use them too much. And then there was, of course, at least two cutoff saws, and probably a couple of saws for each one of them. They were a smaller saw entirely, and generally they were the saw that just had the teeth. A lot of the bigger saws, they come out with a insert type of tooth. They had, you'd buy a box of little teeth that would that you could put into the big saw. I used to like those little teeth. They were just right for a slingshot. Dad Sherman would generally just throw the old teeth in a box there. And boy, I'd have a lot of fun with those old teeth. They were just heavy enough and small enough to really work in a slingshot. So I liked the slingshot. I liked the sawteeth. Getting back to the saws themselves, this one time, let's see, I was working on the pond out of Pond Monkey, and I don't know what happened. Seemed like some of the bigger logs, the logs that we're using, had a bunch of pitch in them or something, and I don't know whether Dad Sherman was sawing at the time or not, but anyway, I think they had three main saws, and they goofed all three of them up some way, and they were using one of the top saws, which is smaller, and they said to me, as a pond monkey, that send us all small logs, the diameters, not, they gave me a certain diameter to send, that so they could saw. So they sawed the rest of the afternoon with this top saw on the bottom place. And as I remember it, Mom got to go into Portland. She was sent into Portland to pick up a saw. I think we had the, what they called a Page Detroit sedan at the time. It was a big, pretty big car. And there was room enough to put one of these saws onto the back seat, like. So she got to go into Portland and pick up this saw. So we had it the next day to use. And then I think probably they worked on those saws some, hammered them and whatnot, and got them ready to go anyway for the next day. It seemed like I'm always getting off of the subject. This was supposed to be about the woods. So I'll have to get back in the woods pretty soon. Sherman never liked to drive, so as soon as I got big enough and to drive, why I drove around to the various, when he would be looking for a sawmill location or something like that, why I'd do all the driving. Prior to that time, why Uncle Cayley, that's Dad Sherman's brother, did the driving. We had a Model T touring type car, and I watched and seen what he did with all the pedals and so forth. And so one Sunday when nobody was around, like, car was parked up there in a shed near the sawmill. Well, I went up and started up, and I run it back and forth a few times and found out exactly what the pedals would do and everything. And from then on, why, I could drive. See, in those days, you didn't have a license or anything. You just got in and drove. I'd take Dad Sherman around to these various places where he wanted to look at some timber or a mill or something. So, of course, I kind of got educated on all this stuff, all the various woods operations and so forth. Dad Sherman was very good on a magnetic compass. He could take a map or plot of ground or trees and see the surveyors had already gone through and made what we call corners on the various parts of the timber and whatnot. Sometimes it'd be a pile of rocks. Of course, generally underneath it would be a metal stake way down where people wouldn't get a hold of it. And but it'd be a pile of rocks, or lots of times there would be what we called a blaze, B-L-A-Z-E, I think. They'd take an axe and cut a chunk of bark off of a side of a tree, and sometimes a lot of these men were real good with an axe. They could, well, actually, they tell the story of them sharpening the axe up and shaving their face. I don't know about that. They had straight razors when I was around. But anyway, they would cut in some kind of a mark in there, a plus mark or a cross mark or a minus mark or something, and they would note that on their map so that when you come there, why, you'd see this blaze and you knew that was fairly close to where the corner was. He would take this magnetic compass and get a bearing, and he'd go through the woods there for maybe a half or three-quarter of a mile or more, and he would come out, say, within 40 or 50 feet of where this corner was, the blaze or whatever it was, and he's real good at that. Most of the time, I would just stay with the car. I tell you, he didn't want to talk much because I could answer whatever question he did, but he didn't want to talk much because he was pacing out the distance and also counting the trees and whatnot, so that he didn't want to talk much. Most of the time, I stayed in the car. This particular time, he wanted me to go along with him. This line, or from one corner to the other corner, followed this little creek. And this little creek wound in and out, in and out, in and out. And he would have me go up ahead of him, maybe as far as he could see me, and go around this one section of creek. And he'd wave to me one way or the other so that he got me right on line. And then he'd come and get me, or come up there where I was, and start out again. He didn't want me to move around any. I could sit down, but he didn't want me to move around any, because that would get him out of line. So, like I say, he was real good with a magnetic compass. Like I said before, he knew his timber. All of the dead tops and the fungus on the side, the conch, and the shakes, so forth. He knew what would make good lumber. So when his brother Keeley, I think, and also his brother-in-law, Ed Stanwood, found a mill that they could lease or buy out in the Gales Creek area here above Forest Grove, Washburn to be exact, way they formed a company, called it Sherman Stanwood, and they run that little mill. I forgot now, 4 or 5 years, something like that. Then it burned up for some reason or other. I don't know how, can't remember now why. Anyway, it burned up. I don't know what Ed Stanwood did, but Keeley, the brother, he went to work in St. Helens for Pope and Talbot as a millwright there in their mills. His wife's family was there in St. Helens anyway. So he went to work for them. In this particular mill, we didn't do the logging. We just bought the logs. I mentioned somewhere in some of the tapes of there being a little logging road with planks laid down and little trees put in between, so that the old World War I army truck couldn't run off. I just spoke of that little mill burning up, but there was another mill there within about a half a mile of this one, and it wasn't in operation, and it was owned by some bank in Hillsboro, so Dad Sherman made some arrangements for leasing it or whatever, and we operated it for 4 or 5 years till it finally burned up. This tape is supposed to be logging tape, so I've got a story here on the logging. We had the people who owned the mill had dammed up Gales Creek at that point, and it was a nice great big pond, and we had various loggers bring logs to us, and we paid them as per 1,000 board feet, whatever it was. Well, this particular day, Dad Sherman was gone. So this fella come in with a load of logs, and it was pretty poor. And I went out, and only one oak that could, I went out and scaled them. And we had a kind of scale. It was like a carpenter's square, except a little bigger. And on one side, it had the number of inches that the diameter of the log was. And on the other side, it had the number of feet that the length of the log. And you put these inches up there under the feet, and you come out with the number of board feet there was in this log. So I scaled the log, and they were pretty poor. So as I remembered, I cut them about 10%. In other words, cut off about 10%. Well, this fellow running the truck, he got paid by the amount of board feet that he delivered. Well, if it was cut 10%, that cut 10% off of his price, off of his money. So he wasn't happy about that at all. So, oh, this damned kid, you know. And so he waited around there till Dad Sherman come. And Dad Sherman looked at him, and he cut him about twice as much. Consequently, that logger, or that truck driver, he quit hauling any logs to us at all. He wouldn't haul logs to us. Dad Sherman had made some arrangement to have a section of land, section of timber up above, well, at Soda Springs. It was west of Gales Creek, fairly close to our mill operation. And we took all the good logs off. That was along in the 20s. And the interesting thing is that I understand that it has been logged twice since and taken off all the logs. Of course, now, in those days, we didn't want cedar, fir, hemlock. Just the old good Douglas fir was what we wanted. I see this is coming to the end of this tape, so I'll have to say, have a good day. This is Carl Sherman, and this is tape number 5. Of the sawmill series. I tried my best to keep the logging and the sawmill separate, but I didn't succeed in doing so. I got off on, something would bring up something around the sawmill, and I'd get off on the sawmill or get off on the logging one way or the other. So this time I'm going to kind of go for some of the sawmill plus what we call safety now. Safety wasn't even a word in the dictionary hardly in the early logging days. Make one good statement here, that in all of our 15 years or so of running sawmills and logging outfits, we never killed a man. We got awful close to it a time or two, and things associated with it were there some fatalities, but none of our men was fatal at all. So that was kind of a good mark in our favor. One thing is Dad Sherman, a pretty good judge of workmen, he wouldn't hire anybody who hadn't at least some experience, or he would put them on a job that that they didn't have to have too much experience on. So consequently, we got pretty good loggers and pretty good mill men who had, say, done the same job before, maybe all the rest of their life. So that's the reason we got the loggers and so forth from Maine and from Canada. They had been working with it, and they realized the dangers and so forth. There was one outfit, of course there might have been other outfits, that one of the things they were kind of highballing, but to say, trying to go faster, trying to do more. I referred to it one time about when they would fall a tree, they'd just cut the top out of it and let the limbs break off as they were drug in with a donkey engine. And consequently, those limbs would catch up on something and then pretty soon they'd let loose and throw a piece of limb or wood or bark or something any old direction. So you had to really watch out for that. This one highball outfit that I know of, the name was Flory, F-L-O-R-I-E probably, I don't know. Anyway, they did quite a lot of logging in the coast range here, and they were a highball outfit, and I don't know whether how true this is, but they used to say that, of course, he'd hire anybody off the street or anywhere, and one of the joker setters or something would get in the way, and it'd kill him. Just put him over there on a stump somewhere. We'll probably have one or two more before the day's over. Boy, I didn't like that idea at all. Like I said before, we had some real close calls. One of them I spoke about quite extensively was the White Indian. That was on the first tape. Somebody said that, what was he doing up there? What did he go up there for anyway? All of the blocks and wire rope and everything was all done. He said, what is he up there for? Well, I'll kind of have to go into a offset here about bearings. The reason he was up there, or went up there, he had to go up there periodically to oil or grease these two big blocks that were up there. And of course that was a high climber job to do that. And I can't say how often he had to do it. Some of those blocks run fairly fast at times and then slow at others, but they had an awful lot of weight on them, so they had to be pretty big and pretty heavy and slide pretty easy to make keep the thing in operation. So he went up there in the bosun's chair to oil these blocks. Now, along about this same time and earlier, well, they had very poor iron and other stuff to make a bearing. See, a bearing is the part that actually rubs on the other part that holds it. Say, in the case of a block, they have this pulley, and the center of this pulley would have some kind of a support in the center of it, shaft or whatever, and the pressure between the two of them would tend to make them wear. Well, you always look for the best material you could. Now, iron on iron isn't considered very good. It will wear pretty well. But iron or the steel on some of the a brass would be copper and tin. And then by making the bearing as large as necessary, they could hold the proper weight. Some of the other bearings were Babbitt bearings. I helped the engineer a time or two. The on the steam engine that run the sawmill. Yeah, I'm back to the sawmill. Run the sawmill. Why it would wear? It was a Babbitt bearing, and periodically, maybe every 6 months or so. Why you'd have to take the old Babbitt out, and we'd take and clean that all out, heat it up some, and put new Babbitt in it. They had a regular form there to put it in, and then any little protrusion that come up, why we would take a round type file or scraper and scrape that all off nice and smooth and make it real good. So the high climber had to go up and oil the block. Another occasion, I referred to it, we had this tramway there in Oliquah, and when this a railroad car that brought the logs down broke loose and come down toward the sawmill. Of course, they gave the five whistles and everybody cleared out of the sawmill. But that could have, well, of course, people looked out for everybody else in those days. You didn't pay. If anybody got in the way and you knew it and they didn't know it, you'd give them a shove or something. You'd get them out of the way. You took care of your fellow workmen there. So they give the five whistles. Of course, the mill picked it up and give the five whistles, and all the men run out of the sawmill, especially they come down there anywhere in line with the tramway. That could have been a real catastrophe through there, but somehow it was averted. That derail, fortunately, was where it should be. And like I said before, the car and the logs hit this derail and jumped about 20 feet in the air over into the pond. That kind of collected the whole thing all at once. So, and it wasn't too hard, as I remember, to get it out of the pond. So that was one thing we bypassed. I just give these as they come to mind. Talking about railroads, we had a old fella. Now, in those days, anybody who was 60, 55 and 60, that was old. They were old, and a lot of them decrepit and various things. We had this one fella, I think he had a farm there somewhere close. He was hauling lumber for us. He had a wagon, and he would, we were about a mile from the railroad, and he'd load up and take them down there. I don't know how he was paid by the day or whatever, but he had the two horses. And this one day, I don't know why, he took a notion to go home or something. I remember that I was in school at the time, so we got out at 3:30, so he, it happened just before we got out of school. Of course, we were about, half a mile away on the school. I think we heard the bang or whatever. This train coming down from Seattle, and the railroad station was in between the train and the crossing. Somehow or other, now, I don't know, he might have been partially deaf. I don't know about that. But anyway, he went across this crossing, and the train hit him. Now, these log wagons were made in two sections with a pole in between, and they somehow or other, he wasn't coupled up too short. I don't know just how long, but somehow or other, the train caught the back end of that wagon and, of course, tipped him over and horses and so forth over into a ditch there. And it hurt him and the horses, too, some, but apparently didn't break too many bones. And but he didn't do too much lumber hauling after that, as I remember it. And in about a year or so, he passed away. But if he had been just a part of a minute slower, it would have hit him or hit the horses, and that would have been all she wrote. I have one fatality. I can't really chalk it up to our operation, but it was right next door, and as a kid, I had to go look, of course, and it really gave me a bad time. These two sawmills we had in the Washburn area had railroad sidings, switch and rails run alongside the main tracks, and generally some kind of a dock. The dock was generally about the same height as a railroad car floor for carrying in lumber or whatever you wanted to take in or out of the car. And this particular time they were, I guess the train wanted to get into Wilkesboro. Wilkesboro was down near Banks, where the main line from Portland to the coast come in, and this was more of a spur line, and it went up to a timber logging outfit up above us. And this particular time, I think they were late or something, or they wanted to get in early, and they did what they called a flying switch. Now, a flying switch was, they would uncouple this car that they wanted to put onto the siding, and they'd go down beyond the switch, and then the switch could be turned, and this steam locomotive would rev it up real fast and cut this car loose and allow it to go onto the siding. Well, generally, the brakeman would be on this car, and he would, when he got the car about where he wanted, well, he'd apply the brakes and stop the car along the siding. Sometimes, of course, we had to move it. I'm going to go off on a little corner here, kind of leave things separate. We had a horse, I spoke of her before, Dolly. She would weigh a couple of thousand pounds. And see, these railroad cars weren't always where you wanted them, or close to the pile of lumber or whatever you were going to load. Sometimes they'd be a car length or more away from where you wanted to be, and it made it hard to load. So this particular horse, most all horses, you hook them up to something or other to pull, and it don't come easily. They start to jerk. Well, this this teamster had her really trained. He would hook her up to this boxcar in the way they wanted to go, and she would just lug into it. She would just pull all she could, you know, and she just sit there and pull, and pretty soon the car started to move a little bit, and she'd move one leg and then the other, and that way move the cars. Now, that's, like I say, I'm always getting off on the wrong subject here. Well, they were performing this flying switch. Now, something happened to the rails where they did the work, actually shoved the rail back and forth a little bit so the car would go onto the siding. Something happened there, whether it jumped this switch or what or not, I do not know. But it, instead of going onto the siding, why, it went straight back and hit the caboose. Now, this is something they kind of figured out happened. When this car that they were putting on the siding hit the caboose, well, it bounced. The caboose bounced. And they think that the conductor was on the back of the caboose, and it knocked him off onto the rails. And the caboose ran over him. Now, like I said before, as a kid, I had to go look. And my stomach was upset for two or three days. But all I really seen was two blankets. One on the middle of the rails, and one on the side of the other rail, about 10 feet apart. My stomach still feels a little squeamish when I tell the story. But now, that wasn't one of our men, of course, belonged to the railroad, so I can't really count that as a fatality of our sawmill and logging outfit. As a kid, I roamed around all over the woods and so forth. I generally had a little axe with me, kind of like kind of a Boy Scout axe, I think. I don't think it was a Boy Scout axe, but it was on that pattern, like just a small axe, and always had knife and matches, along with my handkerchief and so forth. Boy, I roamed around all over, and I was always getting into some kind of trouble, like this one time. There was this piece of vine maple folded over underneath the log, like, and I thought, oh gee, that would make an awful nice Indian arrow type bow. So I got out my trusty little hatchet, rusty little hatchet, and I proceeded to whack away on it. And it came loose and hit me in the right leg, I think it was, and knocked me over, tea kettle or whatever, really knocked me down. And I got up, my leg hurt like everything, and I tried a little bit, and hey, I could walk on it. So that kind of spoiled the bow entirely. I forgot all about the bow and arrow thing then. And I think I headed off toward home. Time I got home, my leg was still hurting some. Well, I tried to get the shoe off, and I couldn't get it off. I couldn't get it unlaced. Somehow or other, and I think that's what helped, kept from breaking any particular bones. Of course, I was about 12 at the time. My bones are probably pretty supple and so forth. And like I say, I couldn't get the shoe off. The lacings, well, I'll go back. At that time, there were about four different kinds of shoes. There was the Oxfords, real low, and then there was what we call a regular shoe, a top for about maybe three times what the Oxford was, and then there was a high top, what it would come about halfway up your leg, and then of course there was the logger boots. They were clear up almost to your knee. The high tops, well, the regular shoes sometimes were too. I would have eyes in the lower part of it and lacings, and then from then on up they had these hooks. Well, what happened? These hooks got bent flat, so I couldn't get the lacing out of them. So I had to go hunt me up a screwdriver or some other tool and pry these hooks apart so I could get the lacing loose so I could get my shoe off. Of course, my leg was black and blue there. At where I wasn't supposed to be at the time out there in the logging. I was too close to the logging things, so I didn't dare tell anybody what happened. In thinking back, I think that the loggers and a lot of the other men around the mill and so forth, like I say, I was all over everywhere, and I think they watched out for the boss's kid quite a lot. I think a lot of times when I thought that there was nobody around or I didn't know where I was or anything, somebody knew where I was. Like I say, they looked after the boss's kid. Lots of times in telling these stories, I forget to put in a lot of the particulars as to where, time, and so forth. And when other people happened to let them check these tapes over and say, well, where was that? And so this particular story this morning is my school teacher in Olequah, the Olequah Mill there. See, Olequah, halfway between Portland and Seattle, on the main line, main railroad, there was two tracks, and there was no station master, just a little place for freight to be put in out of the rain. And so this is a school teacher now, and our school, I had to go about 2 miles to school. The school was only about half or three quarters of a mile from the railroad station. This evening, I think she was living up in Vader, which is the next town up from Olequah, out towards Seattle. At this particular night, or evening, well, right after school probably, she went over to the railroad station, and she was going to catch the train, the Portland train, up to Vader, where she lived. And she was standing on the track of the train coming down from Seattle. And the train coming down from Seattle, of course, she was back to it. She was waving this handkerchief or something for the train from Portland to pick her up. And here she was standing on this track of the Seattle train. And the Seattle train was blowing whistles and ringing bells and doing everything. Well, you see, that was kind of a highball area through there. Nobody, very few people got on or got off at the Olequah station. The trains would stop or slow down if there was no passengers to get off at the Vader station, which was a couple of miles up towards Seattle. And then it was about 7 or 8 miles to Castle Rock down the other way. Anyway, this Seattle train, it was really, really a ringing the bell and whistling all kinds of whistles and so forth, and trying to attract this lady's attention. And Dad Sherman seen what was happening, and he was there, 50, 60 feet from her. And he run over there and yanked her off the track. Just in time. The engineer, he gave a couple of whistles and waved to Dad. A real thank you. See, a train going maybe, 35 or 40 miles an hour, which they did through there, sometimes faster. It'd just be almost impossible to stop by the time he's seen her. Say a half a mile away. If he tried to stop and say through on all the brakes and everything, he'd throw all of his own passengers out of their seats and so forth, and probably kill somebody. And he was, you might say, in between a rock and a hard place. He couldn't stop, and he couldn't get her off the track. But Dad Sherman seen what was happening, so he grabbed her off the track. So that's kind of a side story there. That could have been a real fatality. I see I'm always coming to the end of the tape, but I think I've got time enough to put in a little comment anyway about my little brother Wesley and his cousin Nelda, a little girl cousin, that found the dynamite. And I spoke of it before, of course. Found this dynamite, and the thing comes to mind that of course, apparently they just found it and then took it up to Mother. of course, she called Dad Sherman. But if they had have been, this is Carl Sherman, tape number 5, of the sawmill. On the other side of this tape, I run out of tape before I finished a story about my little brother Wesley and his cousin Elda bringing the dynamite up to mother. That pretty well ended that story real quick there. But the thing comes to mind, if they had decided to just play with it a little bit, toss it around, or maybe use a hammer on it or something, it would have been real interesting. I don't think they'd found enough of them to even pick up. So that pretty well ends the dynamite story anyway. As I tell these stories, something else comes to mind all the time. I shouldn't forget the logs rolling over the man. Of course, they were, I spoke before, were piling small logs and squashing him down into the mud. I think it hurt him some. But I don't think it, I'm sure it didn't break any bones. However, as I said before, it's a wonder he hadn't had a bottle there and broke the bottle and then cut him some. Apparently he had been drinking, and probably his body was pretty well relaxed-like. When the logs rolled over him, he was all relaxed. It squashed him right down into the mud. So got up, shook himself, and walked away. And that could have been a real fatality, too. If that had been hard ground there, boy, it would have really flattened him out like a pancake. In kind of clarifying that a little bit, this was at our Oliqua Mill, and when we had, he was our teamster normally. I think when they were pulling those small logs with his team, I think he just used one horse. Maybe somebody else run the other horse, I don't remember. Anyway, probably he had the horse Dolly. He was really stuck on Dolly. He liked Dolly. As far as that goes, I grew up with Dolly. Now, Dolly wasn't a ceramic deal or a rag doll. Dolly was a horse. like I said before, I could just do anything with, either one of the horses. I'd speak to them and so forth. And they would see me. They like to see my apples that I spoke about earlier. I'm sure Dolly was right close there. It could be. She was a smart horse. It could have been that if she was in the way and she seen those logs start to roll, she got out of the way. I never did hear about that side of the story at all. All I heard was that he got squashed down in the mud. In reviewing some of these tapes, I thought of the idea that I've been calling them sawmill and one kid's sawmill. I should have called them steam. Because the sawmill run the steam engine, and they had steam water pumps and steam fire pumps, along with the steam donkey engine. And then later, they used a lot of steam for heating their offices and so forth, and steam for running their dry kiln. On the bigger mills and later, instead of letting the lumber dry in piles, why they, and especially in the wintertime, when they wouldn't dry very good or season good, why they had these big long, well, it was a not a shed because it had all four sides on it, with steam coils in there, and they actually heated this, well, a regular dry kiln, they call it, and they would run the boards through there, piles, generally sideways, so they could run more through. There was a door on each end when they took a pile of lumber out of one end, why they could put one in the other. They had some motorized or chains in there so they could pull the lumber through. So yeah, that was steam. So I should have called this whole thing steam. Ladies were taboo around a sawmill. This one time, Nora was a mother, Willa. She was about, 3 years or 4 years older than I am. She's still alive. Apparently she had been staying in Gresham with a girlfriend there, and her mother was, Nora was cooking at the time, and they came down to Olequah and went down around the sawmill, and they caused trouble. One fellow, he got distracted in some manner, and he reached across his saw, and it cut his arm clear into the bone. It happened that the saw wasn't going very fast, about 200 RPM probably, and the belt was pretty loose, so it actually stuck the saw. But Dad Sherman seen what was happening, and he run those girls back up on the hill, back to the house real quick. One little item I thought about was that her dad, it was Jim Bichong. He was a good carpenter, cabinet maker like. Matter of fact, in Gresham, he did a lot of work in the church, a lot of the pew work and the other parts of the church there. Real nice work. He got a hold of some cedar and got it planed up. And at Christmas time, why, he made up some real nice cedar chests for mom and I think Mamie and I don't know who else, but made a number of these real nice cedar chests, and they were real nice. The man's name was Ives. I can't remember the first name. He had an arm in a sling though for a number of days. Probably he had to go see the doctor. He's kind of a ornery type of cuss. He had actually been a Mountie in the Mounted Police. He's a Canadian. Had been a Mountie, and apparently his wife didn't like him being in the police work, so he resigned from the Mounties, and they came down here in Washington there. Olequah is in Washington. Well, she was doing the cooking, and he was working on this trim saw. Well, the girls distracted him in some manner. So, man, Actually, I don't know really what happened. His wife left him and went back to Canada there in a few days. And then finally he went back to Canada. And then I'm thinking that he applied for his commission or whatever they call it in the mounted police. And he come back and worked for a while and then went back to Canada. I never heard any more from him. Speaking about cut arms and broken arms, brought up the idea that we had this Model T Ford, and I spoke earlier about me learning how to drive it. And there was an awful lot of broken arms. The when you went to crank it, sometimes it would kick back, and if you're not careful, if you let loose of the crank and the crank come around and hit your arm, it'd break it. So there were quite a few broken arms there running Model T Fords. I had one Model T Ford that I don't know, I think the coils were all brand new. Anyway, they're real good coils in it. See, they used these coils and a magneto type thing to make spark for the spark plug. And by rotating the engine, the magneto would charge these condensers, coils in these condensers, and then that would be transformed up into a high spark, which was put on the spark plugs and fire the engine. Well, on this one Model T that I had, why, I don't know how I got onto the idea. I did have a young fellow that I worked with and so forth a lot, who was an electrician and a radio man. It seems like if you stop this Model T, see, now you had these three pedals and your gas was up on the side of the steering wheel, and then you had this switch to switch off the coils or the, to switch off the spark. So I found out that when they went to stop, if I give it a little gas and turn it off just right, when I come to get back in the car, I'd give it a little gas and turn it on just right, the thing would make, would fire once, and then if I would catch it with a gas pedal or something, gas handle, why, I could keep it going. So I got so that I could start my Model T about one time out of three with by just doing this. That was real nice. If I would get out in the car, the wife and I would say we're going to church, I would get out and it would take off for me. Oh boy, that really something.